Welcome to Grant. You're listening to Off the Wall on Swimming World Radio. Here are your hosts, Nathan and Felipe.
Welcome back, one and all, to another edition of Off the Wall on Swimming World Radio. I'm your host, Nathan Jendrick, joined, of course, by Felipe Delgado. This week, we are going to be discussing last week's biggest topic, the U.S. Olympic trials, and we will also be discussing a few other topics that have to do with the financial side of swimming. Felipe, I've got to say, Omaha, beautiful as always, and I think the event just as well run as 2008, and all in all, a fantastic experience, I think, for not just athletes, but spectators as well.
That was an unbelievable swim meet. For anybody who's been around the sport as long as I have, I'm kind of starting to sound like I'm old, but just to see it, how far it's come in such a short period of time, it was unbelievable. It was a spectacle. I mean, just go for the event, just go for the fireworks, go for the announcing, go for the music that comes on when first place finisher touches the wall. I mean, all of that just makes it an unbelievable experience.
No doubt. And I think they even had a couple more cool elements to it than they did in 2008. For example, the first place finisher when being announced to the team rising up from the floor, that was pretty cool. You know, I don't know that anybody really took full advantage of the kind of cool things you could do from that, but that was at least one more just visual way to improve the aesthetics of it. So I kind of like that. But of course, fireworks, names cascading down, and water and light. I mean, it was a very, very cool event. And that's where we'll start the show today. Later on, we'll also chat with Eric Chanteau, a 2008 Olympian, and of course now a 2012 Olympian, but in a separate event. 2008, he competed in the 200-meter breaststroke, and this go-round, he'll be in the 100 meters, as well as we can expect him in the medley relay. So looking forward to talking to him. But Felipe, first thing we have to talk about, of course, is the meet itself. I think we ended up with most of the usual suspects on the team. The events that I noticed, we're seeing kind of some new names, or maybe some people kind of squeak in there, would be the freestyle relays, which I think tends to be where more of the new up-and-comers tend to fall when it comes to making an Olympic team. But who would you say that you were most surprised by on making this Olympic team for the men and for the women?
Man, you put me in the spot. But
I do my best.
You know, I don't think it was a surprise, but I was happy, most happy I could say, for some of the smaller schools, some of the athletes that represent some of the smaller schools as far as swimming is concerned that made it onto the team. And the first person that comes to mind for me is Clark Burkle. So excited that he made the team, simply because having gone to was raised in Louisville, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. I believe he swam for Lakeside growing up. And then going to college, being a relative unknown in the sport, and then coming up and having a banner year in the Olympic year and putting it all together. And then on top of that, the hardest part, qualifying for the U.S. Olympic team. What a year. And so happy to see it come, you know, him being able to make the team, and so happy to be able to be there and see his reaction when he did make the team. I had the opportunity to be pretty close on that particular day to the pool, and I was able to see his reaction. It was pretty genuine, so that was exciting to see.
Yeah, that's definitely one of those good guys you're just always hoping to see do well, and for him to make this Olympic team was really special. He's actually in the same event as who I would say would be the biggest surprise qualifier of the meet for me, and Scott Welts making the 200 breaststroke. And talk about a guy who was just off the hook excited. Seeing his reaction was just one of those things, you're like, they should make a McDonald's commercial with this. I mean, that guy was so excited when he touched that wall first, turned around, and saw that he had made his Olympic dream come true. That was really exciting. I have trouble with this one, saying whether it's a surprise or not, but Connor Dwyer, is that a surprise, or is it that his qualification in the 400 freestyle was just because outside of Peter Vanderkay, you didn't really have anybody that you could really point to and say, that's our guy? I think that one was kind of up in the air, but seeing him also qualify on the 800 free relay, I think really really says a lot for him and his talents over different distances and strokes. But I think it's worth noting, we also have on this team Davis Tarwater in a bit of a surprise, because it took Michael Phelps dropping the 200 freestyle to make that happen. Now, Felipe, this has been kind of discussed a little bit in the comment sections of various articles and on different forums, but what do you think? Do you think Michael Phelps, having trained with Davis and knowing that this was Davis's last go-around, do you think that maybe that influenced his decision to drop that 200, knowing that it would put Davis on the team?
No. Come on. You kidding me? That doesn't ever happen.
No, of course not.
Listen, let's give credit where credit is due first. Did you see, first of all, how many swims Davis Tarwater had at the Olympic trials? How close was he to making it if... In some of the events, if it would have been a 50 shorter, he would have made the team, okay? The guy gave it everything he had on every single swim, left his heart in the pool. And you know what? He might not have made it, but if he made it on a technicality, so be it. I'm never going to get in the middle of that and argue that he shouldn't be on a team or try to find out the reasons as to why Michael Phelps pulled out. Look, let's just look at it in the way it should be looked at. Davis Tarwater is a 2012 U.S. Olympian. That's all that matters.
No doubt, and I'm happy as can be for him. Interesting, I was having a discussion with somebody that was talking about him, and this person I was speaking with was commenting about how everyone's saying, oh, great for Davis, he deserves it. But the individual I was talking to seemed almost frustrated by it, and he said, well, if he deserved it, he would have made the team on his own. And that wasn't the discussion that I was going to get into, but I thought that was really an interesting term. When you think about it, when people say, oh, he deserves it, what qualify somebody as deserving a spot on the Olympic team? Of course, one would think you touch the wall in a place that earns the trip, then you deserve it. But you know, I'm with you. Technicality or not, this guy's on the team. He's shown for years that he's been a consistently productive swimmer. He's one of the best. So for him to be on the team, I think only does good for the United States. So good for Davis. And yeah,
Davis, don't look back. Brother, you're an Olympian. Enjoy the moment. Enjoy your time in London. In 10, 20 years, they will not even remember that it was on a technicality. They will only know that you were. And
you think it'll even take that long? I'm saying 6 months from now, nobody will remember. They'll just know Davis Tarwater, Olympian.
Davis Tarwater, Olympian. why don't we do this? Let's put an asterisk next to his name. You know?
Oh, geez.
So we know how well that worked out, right, with the whole tech suit era. But no. Absolutely not. David Starwater is an Olympian, and he will always be an Olympian for the rest of his life.
Absolutely. Now, on the women's side, did you find any surprises there? For me, it was actually the women's butterflies that kind of surprised me. Camille Adams in the 200 fly and Claire Donahue in the 100 fly. Obviously, with Natalie Coughlin not swimming up to what most people had expected in the 100 back and 100 fly, it really opened up those events, and of course, I got Rachel Bootsma in that 100 back. But I thought, for me, it was the women's butterflies that was really the shockers for this Olympic trials.
Where's Rachel Bootsma from?
I couldn't tell you.
Rachel Bootsma is, if I'm not mistaken, she's from Eden Prairie, Minnesota. That's where she's from. She's from a small town in Minnesota. I think Eden Prairie is a pretty small town. I was so happy to see her get in. I mean, good for her. Look at those two teenagers going to be representing the United States in the 100-meter backstroke. That's wonderful. That's one of those feel-good stories. I mean, you know what? It was literally, you could see the torch was passed on that race right there. I felt bad. Natalie Coughlin is from our era. It's been an honor to watch her swim for so many years and watch her dominate the sport for so many years, but it's time. And you know what? She couldn't have done it with more grace. She was wonderful in defeat, as well as she's been in her achievements and her success. She was also wonderful in defeat. And for kids to be watching that and for adults to be watching that, she really taught us a lesson. And that is that, you know, there comes a time and a place when the torch needs to be passed, and you must be humble and also honored to have been able to represent the United States for so long, and to understand that the time has come for you to pass the torch and hope that the next person can carry it as well as you did. And I think she did that. She's a class act, that's for sure.
No doubt, and she's still on this 2012 Olympic team, which I think is going to go a long way for our younger swimmers and her leadership and just her knowledge and expertise, I think, is going to do a whole world of good for the team. A couple other swimmers that I was excited to see make the team, Leah Neal. I know that the big thing has been made about, oh, another African-American swimmer. You know, that part, that really doesn't matter to me. She's a damn good swimmer, so for her to make this team at her age, I think was just fantastic.
Let's get over that. Let's get over that. They tried to, you know what? Let's go back to 2000. Okay, they tried to make Anthony Irving the first African American. Listen, I trained in 2000 with Anthony Irving. Okay, there might be some, you know, I think his father is African American, but that was the furthest thing on his mind when he made the Olympic team. You know, he was a great swimmer then. He's a great swimmer now. It had nothing to do with his race. It had to do with how great of an athlete he is and how hard he trained to make the team. Liam Hill, forget about that. Get rid of the race card. Let's talk about her being 17 years old. Let's talk about her being from New York. How cool is that?
Yeah, how many swimmers train in Manhattan
get
to reach this level? I mean, it's ridiculous. And you're absolutely right on we need to get rid of the race thing. I think it's wonderful that we can get guys like Colin Jones going out there, reaching out to minorities, increasing their interest in the sport, learn to swim programs. Yeah. I understand that, and it's fantastic. But let's let the kids be inspired. The kids are watching this stuff. They're going to see this stuff. They know. They're going to think, hey, I've got something I can share with that person. I'm going to aspire to be like that person. That's great. The media doesn't need to jump onto it. Let's stop looking at them as, oh, great black swimmers or great white swimmers or what have you. Let's just look at them as, hey, that's a great swimmer. Let's celebrate what they're doing. Let's not try to put it in context of, oh, well, it's their race and that's what makes them so special. No, what makes them special is they dedicate their life to the sport and they reach goals that the rest of us could only dream about.
That's right. You're absolutely right. I mean, you nailed it on the head. Again, it's the furthest thing, I think, from the athlete's mind. I can tell you from Anthony Irvin back in 2000, having trained with him, and I could probably say the same for Leah Neal, that the furthest thing from mine is, oh, great, I made the Olympic team. I'm black. That's awesome. No, that's not really what's on her mind. The fact that she made the Olympic team, be in awe and be inspired by what a 17-year-old out of Manhattan did, than to go immediately to the fact that she's black. That's let's get over that.
Exactly. Let's just say it this way. Leah Neal, awesome.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. Done.
And we'll sum it up that way. One other notable swimmer that I think is certainly worth discussion is Chloe Sutton. How about that? 2008, she makes it in the 10K open water. 2012, she decides she wants to dedicate herself to the pool and her aspirations of making it in the pool, and she does that. How about, I mean, to me, that is huge. Chloe is one of the most talented swimmers we have. She's one of the absolute best people, one of the sweetest people you'll meet in the sport, and she's gone from open water, being America's first open water Olympian, and now she's back at the Olympics, but she's doing it in the pool for the 400 free. To me, that's pretty special to see that kind of versatility.
She's awesome. She continues and carries on the reputation that Mission Viejo Nadadors have of putting distance swimmers on the U.S. Olympic team. This is a girl. She's very young still. What is she? I think, if I'm not mistaken, she's 20. She's got a couple of cool things about Chloe Sutton. One is that she's so young. When she was 16, she made her first Olympic team. She's 20 now. She's made her. It just seems like she's been around forever, so you'd think she was older than that. Apart from that, she's an Air Force baby. She was born on and at Vandenberg Air Force Base. The reason I know a little bit more about her is because I'm from Mission Viejo, so I live right down the street from where she trains. I trained with her coach. I trained with Coach Bill Rose, and she's awesome. And her being able to come from open water and do it in the pool and to qualify, that's kind of cool. That's certainly unique.
No doubt. I don't know that there's a whole lot of swimmers that can be among the best in the world in a 10K race, open water, and then come back and exert that same kind of dominance in only 400 meters. I mean, at 400 meters, I've seen some of Chloe's workouts. I've talked to her about some workouts. The things that she tells me that they do and she enjoys as far as distance and send-offs, it makes me sick. I mean, this is coming from a guy. I swam the 100 breaststroke, the 50 free, and the 200 IM if I had to. I mean, that was it for me. So to hear some of those sets just astonish me. But then to see that she can go, like I said, from among the best in the world in the 10K to a 400 free, which for her, I mean, that's not even warm-up. I don't even know how – I don't even know if she really gets going in 400. But that's why I think it's so special that she can make this Olympic team, take that 400 freestyle, having come from a background that had her focusing just 4 years ago on the open water. So that, I think, is pretty special, and she's definitely one to watch. And that's actually going to take us into our next topic, there's a lot of lists going around. I look at a little popular media from time to time, of course, particularly when it has to do with swimmers, like I'm sure most of our listeners do. And there's been a couple lists out there on the hottest Olympians. RyanSeacrest.com, Bleacher Report has some of their different writers. And Chloe makes all these lists. So absolutely, you know, Chloe, beautiful girl. Other swimmers that make these lists, Natalie Coughlin, of course. I think Stephanie Rice from Australia. She's the same. And it's really that trio that makes those lists. And, of course, I think all absolutely deserved. But another list that caught my eye was on mensfitness.com. They made a list of – and Felipe, I know we're going to upset some people with this, so I'm just going to go ahead and preface this. As we go, some people who, particularly non-swimmers who listen to the show, are not going to be particularly happy, my guess, with what we're about to talk about. But mensfitness.com, 25 fittest Olympians, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, 25 fittest Olympians.
Right.
Michael Phelps doesn't hit the list until 18th. Ryan Lochte hits the list at spot number 3.
Mm-hmm.
1 and 2 are basketball players, and number 1 is LeBron James.
Right.
Now, LeBron James is an absolutely phenomenal athlete.
Right.
The guy is a beast. I have no doubt that compared to 99.9% of the population, he is absolutely in every way more fit. But I'm sorry. There is not one single part of me that can think in an actual fitness standpoint how Michael Phelps makes this list at 18 and how Ryan Lochte is somehow deemed less fit than LeBron James.
Well, Nathan, it is Men's Fitness Magazine. I'm sure they put a ton of scientific research into this.
No doubt about it. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that they went and took body fat measurements, sprint times. I mean,
absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, you know, for them to put LeBron James and Dwayne Wade 1-2, that has nothing to do with selling magazines.
Absolutely not. They would not in any way sacrifice their integrity just to sell a magazine.
It's all about scientific research, and I stand behind Men's Fitness. They know what they're talking about, and I completely agree, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've got boxers on there, and that I can understand. Boxers train like animals, and they can certainly run like crazy. But, I mean, have you seen some of the videos that Ryan Lochte has posted of his training?
Yes.
I don't think that LeBron James does anything close to that. And I'm not saying – I don't expect Ryan Lochte to be able to go out and shoot a basketball the way that LeBron James does. Similarly, I don't expect LeBron James to go swim a 400 IM the way that Ryan does. But if you think strictly from sprint speed, endurance,
mm-hmm.
strength compared to body weight, I'm sorry. I would put – my money, pound for pound, on Ryan over LeBron, no doubt.
It's called the bottom dollar. What makes us most money? And who's hot right now? Who's hot right now is LeBron James. I mean, the guy just won an NBA title. Because if you're really talking about fitness, where's Kobe Bryant? I mean, the guy has been is known for his regimen. So where is Kobe Bryant? You know, where are some of the other guys that could be? But honest to God, Men's Fitness Magazine, they're going to put there whoever sells. They're going to put on there whoever's hot, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. I just saw this, and I couldn't help but laugh. And I had to ask myself, I was like, maybe I'm biased. You know, I'm sure I'm biased. But if you look at that in just any logical way, there's no way that Phelps hits this list at 18 and we deem LeBron more fit than Ryan. But, you know. I digress. It is what it is.
It is what it is.
I know we're going to have some listeners that disagree with us, some diehard basketball fans, but I would certainly be interested in hearing how, if you're talking pound for pound, endurance, sprint, whatever, how we get basketball players in front of guys like Phelps and Lochte. But maybe we'll have somebody with actual scientific research. We'll be able to explain that to us. But
Dude, our day is coming. We're going to get the respect that we deserve at some point. So it might not be in Men's Fitness Magazine, but we're going to get the respect. And you know what? It's already started. We've already seen it. I mean, we got swimmers. Who would have ever thought? We've got swimmers gracing the covers of, you know, worldwide global magazines, which is really cool. So
Yeah, you know, going through that list, I was half expecting to see Tiger Woods, but, you know, I mean, you know, if he hadn't had all that negative press in the last couple of years, that they'd have put Tiger Woods on there somehow.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, no doubt about it. That probably would have made Ryan fourth and Michael 19, because somehow Tiger Woods would be second to LeBron.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, whatever. Now, next topic we're going to go on to before we chat with Eric Chanteau is there's been a couple that I've seen, and there's probably more, but I caught a clip online of a Mesa, Arizona TV station featuring Bria Larson's family. And, of course, being up here in Seattle, I had also seen some topics or some news, some articles and such about Ariana Cougar's family. And the similarity here is that both families are trying to raise money to get the families to London to cheer on their family members, of course, their swimmers. And in a lot of these things, you see comments either by the newscasters or people being interviewed, commenting, what have you, where they feel that it should be either a sponsor's job or the NGB's job to shell out for the families to be able to go to the Olympics to watch. Now, I'm gonna preface this by saying a full disclosure that, you know, my wife competed in the 2008 Olympic Games in Beijing, and that was not a cheap trip, was not paid for, had to do it on my own. So I'm going to say I would love for that to be the case, but Felipe, you know, you have to ask, if that would be deemed, hey, let's send the families, you have to ask, where does it stop? I noticed on the clip that I watched, Bria Larson is among seven. There's seven other children in her family, plus the two adults, her parents. So that'd be nine to send, and you can assume, you know, $1,000 a night at a hotel. Plane tickets could be a couple $1,000. Where does it stop? And does it only extend to spouses, parents, kids? What do you think about all this?
Well, I think where does this, you know, you say where does it stop? Where does it start, actually? I mean, does it ever get started? I mean, is there a fine line that you walk when you say, hey, listen, you've made the Olympic team. That's great. Now we're going to take who? We're going to take mom and dad. If you're married, we're going to take your spouse. If you've got kids, we're going to take your kids. I mean, where does it start? You know, before you answer where does it stop, you got to start with where does it start? I think what United States Swimming is doing is they're taking the high road for now until they can figure out what's fair and what's just. So, personally, I competed in the Olympic Games. My family was able to go. My mother and my father were able to go to the Olympic Games on their own dime. It's a very expensive trip. But again, for many athletes, it's a once-in-a-lifetime event. So for particular athletes, like in this case, for their families to go out and try to fundraise, that's the right way to do it. Look, as swimmers, Nathan, we grow up fundraising. Most teams across the United States are non-for-profit teams. So we grow up fundraising. So this would be just another fundraising activity that you'd have to do, and this one just with a little more sentiment if it's your daughter or your son who's made the Olympic team. So I think for now, I think USA Swimming takes the high road on this one. But I think it might be something that in the future they may take a look at and say, okay, maybe we can help to a certain extent, but that's it. I know once the families get to the Olympic Games, I know they do. Speaking with some of my close friends that are on the U.S. Olympic team, the U.S. Olympic Committee does some sort of raffle, or they do give away tickets to family members, or maybe for one event, or maybe even for just the day that their swimmer is going to be swimming or participating. But outside of that, it's pretty much, again, you're on your own. They'll give you maybe a couple of tickets to prelims, a couple to finals, and outside of that, you're on your own. If that, I've heard in some cases, they're not even able to get that. So who knows? I'm on the fence on this one. I don't know if USA Swimming steps in at this time. I think it's something that they need to sit back, take a look at, and see what's fair, and then proceed at that point. So,
well, I'll tell you, you ask where it starts. I'll tell you where it starts. Whoever drives these kids to swim practice their whole life before they make team, to me, that's a guaranteed trip. I mean, come on. That's that's a part of the team right there. I think if your mom or your dad or both are driving you to swim practice for 15 years or whatever so that you can achieve your Olympic dream, hey, I would love to see mom and dad get out there and be able to go. But you're right. It's rough. I know everyone wants this to work out, and I know everyone would love for their families to be there. But, it comes down to dollars, and it's rough because you're limited to the economics of scale, of course. How many hotel rooms is going to decide how much things cost? Transportation, when it's not in an English-speaking country, you have to look at all these different facets of getting people to and from, and the currency involved, and, food and airfare, where it's at, is all going to depend. And then, of course, you have it. Well, if one person has six family members and the other person only has one, I mean, is there some way you're supposed to, subsidize? Or it's rough. But, I mean, we've got, 23 men on the team and 24 women, I think it is, plus coaching staff. If you were to add up the cost to send all of their families, it would be a substantial amount of money. Do I think it's a wise investment? Absolutely. Do I think it's realistic that it will ever happen? You know what, Felipe, I don't know about you, but I don't see that ever coming to fruition.
Probably not. And I think that's where, with swimming gaining popularity, I think at some point, to be honest with you, Nathan, I see the sponsors taking care of that. I think you mentioned that earlier. But I do. I see the sponsors taking care of that. I see it becoming kind of like the Olympic trials. I see it becoming more of a grander event, the Olympic Games, when it comes to family. So I think within the next 4 years, I think we see a major change and a major shift in who is responsible for these types of events. And I don't believe it's going to – I think it's going to go away from USA Swimming, to be honest with you. I really do. I think anytime you put that kind of pressure on the governing body, most of the time you're disappointed with the results. So I think the individual private companies step in. And with swimming gaining more in popularity, I think it becomes easier for families of swimmers who make the Olympic teams to get to the games to actually see their kids compete.
Yeah, I think what we might see on the NGB level is finding more, at least competitive pricing through their associates. I know that in 2008, when I was looking into it after Megan had made the team, USA Swimming has a travel agency that they work with and that they offer deals through. But the pricing, just to be blunt, was ridiculous. Right. The amount that they wanted to charge me for what I'd need to go support Megan was just exponentially higher than what I was able to put together myself. I understand you, of course, are paying for somebody's labor to do the work and put it together for you. But this was several times the amount of my plane tickets and hotel and whatnot. So that's one heck of a labor cost. So at least what I'd like to see on the NGB role is, at least getting more competitive pricing. You would think, and of course I don't know how this stuff works in that kind of industry, but I would think that with that kind of volume and their connections, I mean, let's be honest, USA Swimming has some of the best sponsors in the world, I think, when it comes down to sports. Whether it be airlines, oil companies, they've got the hotel sponsor. I mean, they've got great connections. So I'd like to see them put that to use. But what started this all, of course, is seeing how Cougars family is selling Team Cougars T-shirts. I wish I had the link for you. I don't. If you're interested in supporting them, please Google that. I think their Facebooks or Ariana's fan page that would also have information. Or email the show and we'll find the link for you. Please support them if you'd like. Same for Bria Larson's family. One thing that I thought was interesting is in that segment that I watched, Bria Larson's family was talking about, and I don't know how accurate this is just what was said on the segment. They were saying that they can't sell the same T-shirts that they were wearing, which said Team Larson, London 2012 on there. They can't sell those because it's her name. And it's an NCAA violation. To me, that was ridiculous. Are you kidding? You can't sell something with your own last name because you compete at the NCAA level? That's asinine.
Yeah, that's it's hard to believe that the NCAA would get to that point to not allow these athletes to sell something with their namesake on it. I mean, give me a break. I think that's a little getting a little petty, but that's what it is. It's a governing body, and you have to abide by their rules, and hopefully after the Olympic year, maybe put some pressure on them to change their rules.
Yeah, I understand the NCAA is a business like anything else, but I mean, to not be able to sell a T-shirt because it has your name on it and you swim in NCAA competition, I mean, this is trying to get your family to watch you at the Olympic Games. And God help me, I understand the NCAAs are a big deal, but the Olympic Games, a little bit bigger.
Right.
I know that we won't go into that in this show. It'd be beating a dead horse. Lots of people, opinions on the NCAA. Some, you know, well thought out. Some just, you know, heat of the moment type stuff. But yeah, it's too bad. But anyway, for any listener that want to support these athletes or any others that might be out there trying to raise money to send family members, by all means, please think about doing that. If nothing else, you get a cool T-shirt, right? You know, wear it when you're watching the games around your friends. Increase awareness for swimming and help get some family members to the Olympic Games. It really means a lot. I'm sure, Felipe, you can speak to it, but I know to Megan it meant a lot that myself, as long as her parents, were able to put together the finances to go and watch, and I'm sure that your family felt the same way when you competed in the Olympics.
That's absolutely. It's, you know, it's once in a lifetime for a lot of these athletes. So it's having their families, their loved ones, and like you said earlier, mom and dad who have been taking them to workouts since they were very young, having them there is so special. Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, and I don't think this is talked about enough, in a lot of cases, that cannot happen just because of economics. So
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely right. And that can't be understated. So again, if you're interested in supporting these athletes or any other athletes, and help them get their families, please check it out online and go for it and do that. It'll mean a lot. So,
right.
All right. Those were our topics for today. I'm really excited about who we're about to bring on the line. He has a phenomenal story. In 2004, third place finishes. 2008, makes the team, but does so having just heard days before that he's been diagnosed with cancer. 2012, comes back 3.5 years without cancer, makes the team. I'm sure that the sentiment from one trials to the next and his thought process are something that most of us will never be able to understand. So I'm very excited to bring our guest on. And joining us on the show now is a member of your 2012 Olympic team, Eric Chanteau. Eric, first, congratulations on making the team, and thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we'll start off nice and easy for you. I was reading your Twitter a couple days ago, I guess the day that you guys got to, or that you got to training camp, and it sounds like, at least from what people are saying, you're a bad luck charm on travel. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, you know, the past couple flights I've been on, whether it was coming here or a couple weeks ago going over to trials, you know, I've just not had the best luck traveling, whether it's delays, mechanical problems, canceled flights, rerouting me through different cities, whatever. I'm looking for my luck to change. So hopefully as we get across the seas and get over to London, it'll start looking better for me. But yeah, travel's been kind of brutal lately.
Well, and, you guys were able to actually spend some time after trials back at home, which was unique for the U.S. team. Normally they ship people from trials right into training camp. So that was I'm sure a welcome change. What did you, other than enduring bad travel, of course, what did you do for your couple days off before you had to get to Knoxville for training camp?
Yeah, so it was pretty nice, with the staff letting us get home after trials and just kind of, rest and relax a little bit and really have an end to the trials trip. And really, spent my days doing some laundry, getting caught up on being disconnected from the world for about a week and a half of trials, and just kind of relaxed on the couch and you know, prepared for the next 3.5 to 4 weeks that are in front of me. So it was nice to get home and just kind of get in the atmosphere for a little bit.
Do you feel, compared to 2008 when you reported right to training camp in California, do you feel like you're fresher now and more ready to go into training camp, or is it not really any different?
You know, I definitely think there is a difference this year as opposed to going straight there in 2008. You know, like I said before, having a break really gives you a chance to put an end to two Olympic trials and then put a beginning on Olympic Games rather than having them all just run together into one big trip. So I think looking at it like that really makes things a little bit easier to keep it fresh for the next 3.5 weeks.
Good. Now, before we actually get into trials and talk about London, let's talk about what got you to trials and onto this Olympic team. You switched teams to Trojan Swim Club, and I had actually heard on deck a couple people, spectators, were surprised to see that. I guess they hadn't followed beforehand. So could you tell us a little bit about how that happened and how that came about and what took you over to California to train under Dave Falo?
Yeah, you know, I went out to train under Dave in February of 2011. I made the move. And for me, it was really a desire and a want to do something totally different. You know, I felt like I kind of needed to shock my system in terms of training. And, you know, Dave's program and his philosophy gave me the opportunity to do that. You know, he's got a pretty unique training style. You could call it quality over quantity, but you know, I really don't think that encompasses it all. You're really just focused on going as fast as you can, as much as you can. So you really learn to race during workout and to take your training speed to a whole new level. So, you know, for me, going into this summer, I really wanted to do something that was outside of my comfort zone, and that was kind of the big motivation to come out here to California and train with Dave.
So the workouts you talk about being quite a bit different than what you were used to, but what about technique? Obviously, Dave has a fantastic resume, particularly with the breaststroke, but you've had such amazing success before going to him. When you reached Trojan, did he try and adjust your technique or anything, or did he really just focus on giving you a different way to develop speed in your stroke by the workouts?
Well, you know, Eddie and Chris over at the University of Texas, I mean, they really gave me the base breaststroke technique that I have today. And Dave wasn't looking to reinvent my breaststroke in any way, shape, or form. I mean, you know, Eddie and Chris did such a good job changing my stroke and making me the breaststroker I am today. Dave just wanted to you know, get a fresh pair of eyes on it, and he didn't try to break down or change my stroke very much at all. It was just a few minor adjustments here and there, you know, getting into a better line at the end of each stroke and really digging into my catch at the corners of my stroke. So it was little adjustments, but nothing too big.
Good. Well, clearly it's worked out well for you. So let's talk about trials. Were you able to put all that together and get it to work and get yourself on another Olympic team? Before we get into the breaststroke, so I wanted to ask, this is just my personal curiosity. You've had a great career swimming the IMs over the years, and with all the media sensation around Phelps and Lochte and the 2 and the 400 IMs, was there any temptation for you to try to expand your event schedule a little bit and step in there and mix it up with those guys and try to get on the team in one of those marquee events?
You know, I've spent my whole career as the third fastest American, especially in that 200 IM. And it was kind of a joke after 6 years of getting third at trials meets. I was like, okay, I'm gonna let somebody else take over that position. So, you know, I was fine not swimming the 200 IM or any of the IMs for that matter at this trials. I really enjoyed just being able to focus on the breaststrokes.
Well, when it comes down to trials, you have certainly got a story of perseverance and just overcoming so much. Let's talk about that. In 2004, you were hoping to make your first Olympic team. You had the anxiousness that comes along with that, and you had those third place finishes. In 2008, you make the team, but you do so having just been told that you had cancer. Now, 2012, 3.5 years cancer-free, you're married, you have a new team. It seems like you finally got to go into a trials meet without any kind of burden on your back. How did it feel to swim in 2012 as compared to 2008 and 2004?
Swimming this year at trials was just much easier to say the least than, you know, 2008 and even 2004. And you know, I can't tell you how much more I just enjoyed racing and just enjoyed being at trials itself. I mean, it is a very unique event. I think it's, you know, in my opinion, Olympic trials for the U.S. is probably one of the best meets in the world. So it was nice to go into this without anything actually hanging over my head or without any kind of, you know, big deals for me outside the pool. So it was relaxing a little bit, you know, and it was nice to be able to just focus on competing and just focus on swimming.
Did you still have any nervousness before your races? I know that it varies so widely for athletes. Some say that after a while they just don't get nervous anymore. Others say, yeah, I still get nervous and I think it's a good thing. After everything you've gone through, I guess it'd be hard to fathom that you could actually still get nervous. But going into trials, did you have any of that anxiousness and before your swims?
Well, it's kind of interesting. You know, for the past couple of years, I really haven't gotten that nervous, especially for meets and sees or anything like that. And I thought that would kind of hold true for Olympic trials. But I'll be honest with you, I was very anxious and pretty nervous for these trials. And I think that just comes with the whole territory of the Olympic trials themselves. I mean, it's so difficult to make the U.S. team, and they're really a meet where you can't look past it, you know, no matter who you are. So it was definitely a pretty stressful week. I mean, racing under those kind of conditions and having to get the job done is something that's always been very difficult. But at the same time, I've always really enjoyed doing and really embraced. I enjoy racing on a big scene. I enjoy racing under a lot of pressure. So, you know, I feel like I was able to do that, and you know, it was great that I was able to put myself back on another Olympic team.
Now, with those breaststrokes, you've got the American records in the 100 and the 200. Which event, particularly now that you're with Salo and going to a more sprint-oriented program, going into the trials in Omaha, what were you considering your better event, the 100 or the 200?
You know, going into trials, I was definitely more on the 200. I mean, I've, you know, having the American record in the 100 is something that, you know, a lot of people don't associate with me. But it's still something that I enjoy racing. You know, my focus has always been train for the longer distance, focus on the longer distance, and just see how fast you can go in the shorter one. So, you know, going into trials, my focus was definitely on the 200, and I was just going to kind of see how the 100 went.
Yeah, you're right. I think that there is kind of this assumption that you're a 200 breaststroke swimmer, and you're right. People don't, for some reason or another, really associate that 100 record with you, but you did make the 2008 team in the 200. But in 2009, just a year later, you swam the 100, you break the record, you're on the medley relay that won gold and set a world record. So certainly I think anybody would be remiss to not think of you as a threat in the 100. Of course, come these trials, first event, the 100, you make the team. After making it in 2008 in the 200 and not the 100, was there a sense of relief or even maybe a little surprise after the 100 when you hit the wall, turn around, and realized that you made the team?
There was definitely both. I mean, I think about making all the events you want to, and obviously being the first one, you think about it so much, and then to actually see it happen and have it become a reality is always, I don't want to say surprising as much as it is just relieving, but it definitely took some of the pressure off, and it was definitely nice to have that team spot already secured in the 100 after just the second day of the meet. So, you know, it was nice to have 100 come together and have a good swim in that event when I really needed to.
Now, clearly you've been able to perform extremely high levels as a member of the relay. Like I mentioned, I just mentioned that 2009 relay world championships winning the gold. But was there any extra excitement making the 100 knowing that you were going to be able to swim that swim a breaststroke leg on the American medley relay at an Olympics now instead of just world championships?
Well, you definitely want to always put yourself in a position to be on a relay. You know, anybody who makes a national team is up for a relay spot, and everybody wants those relay spots. They're pretty coveted. So it's nice to be in a position now where I have a chance to get on the relay, and you know, now the job is to just race as fast as I can in the individual event to put myself in contention for that relay.
Now let's move on to the 200. At these trials, you placed third after this being your Olympic event in 2008. You're 8/100 behind Clark Burkle. Can you tell us how that race felt and what you were thinking during that race?
You know, the 200 was pretty tough for me this year. You know, coming in third was not the most fun experience. But you know what? I look back on that race and I gave it everything I had. And, you know, I just came up a little bit short. And, you know, that's the way these things happen. But after what I did in 2008 with blowing out a little bit too hard and kind of hurting on that last 50, I really was conscious of, you know, having to swim a smart race this time around. And I really felt like I did that. And I really controlled my first 100 and really felt like I had easy speed going out. But, you know, again, that last 25 for me at these trials and that 200 was one of the most painful last 25s I've ever had in any race. And, you know, Clark and Scott both had great last 50s and they had a great finish. And, you know, I look back and just think that that was all that was, you know, the best that I had that day. And that's where we ended up. But at the same time, you know, it was hard for me to be really upset because I knew I was already going to London as it was.
Right. Yeah, it's certainly something to – you can't really get down when you've already achieved the dream and put yourself back on another Olympic team. I think that's a great outlook. We've talked about the distance. We know it's not a problem for you. You do have the American record in the 100. But now this is really the – I guess you could say the first major meet that you're able to go in just focusing – on the 100. In 2008, of course, you're able to focus just on the 200, but now you can go into an Olympics on a shorter distance. So are there any adjustments that you need to make now that that's the solo event that you're focusing on for London?
Well, there will definitely be some adjustments that I'll make over the next couple of weeks in these training camps as we get ready for the 100 at the Games. You know, I've already talked about it with Dave, and, you know, we're not worried about conditioning during the training camps over the next couple of weeks. It's not a problem. The conditioning is there. At this point, we're just going to need to find a little bit more strength and find a little bit more speed. And, you know, hopefully we can do that and come back to London with a faster 100 than I had in Omaha.
Now, how is it? How does it feel to have your current coach and your former coach both as coaches on the Olympic team?
Well, I've actually got former coaches. I am probably the most coached athlete at this training camp. I have David Marsh on staff, who I swam for in college, and then Eddie Reese on staff, who I swam for professionally for 4 years, and now with Dave Salo. So I really am fortunate enough to have, you know, every coach I've swam for in the past decade or so here on this trip. So it's pretty neat, you know. I think that's pretty incredible to have these guys all here with me and all supporting me and all making sure that I'm going to do the best I possibly can in London. And, you know, these are the guys that made me the swimmer I am today. So it's pretty neat just to have them here and have them be part of the process.
Now, Team USA has four different men competing throughout the two breaststrokes. That's not unheard of, but often we'll see a swimmer in one event or another on the men or the women's side that'll double up in both the 100 or the 200. We don't have that for breaststroke this time around. So does that help you at all in training camp, having three other great male breaststrokers to train with, or is it really not any different to you?
Well, you know, we were in this position in 2008 with having four different breaststrokers for the men across the board. And I don't, because we are broken up into our smaller training groups here at the camp, I don't think it's makes that big of a difference, because we're with our individual coaches. But you know what? I say that, and then there are some days where, you know, we'll all want to do a big breaststroke workout and all come together as kind of a bigger training group. And it makes for a really fun training session and makes for it to be very competitive. And that's always fun to have. You know, when you've got the best guys in the country all training together, working towards the same goal of the Olympics, you know, it's pretty neat when all that can kind of come together for a training session. So, you know, outside of the one or two times that'll happen, I don't think it's that big of a difference. But, you know, that being said, it is pretty neat when we all do get to really go head-to-head for a big training session.
Now, having been a part of two Olympic teams, I know that the team just got together a couple of days ago, but you were, of course, able to watch a little bit of trials when you weren't swimming and now together as a team. Give me your early thoughts on how you feel this team shapes up to the team of 4 years ago.
Well, I think this is a very different team. You know, always are. A lot happens over the course of 4 years. You know, new guys come up, old guys retire, and some people stay the same, you know. So it's always fun to have, you know, kind of new faces around the Olympic team. And, you know, this year is no different. We've got a lot of young kids, and that always puts a lot of fresh energy around the team and a lot of fresh excitement for these international meets. So, you know, I think this is going to be just as strong of a team as we've ever had. And I know the U.S. is always the country when it comes to swimming with the target on our back, and I don't think this year is any different. So, you know, it's our job to really set the benchmark for the rest of the world, and you know, we're going to go into London looking to improve on the trials we had. And, you know, as long as we get faster, I think we'll be in good shape.
Aside from your breaststroke, the breaststroke events, Eric, is there any particular event that you're looking forward to seeing in London in the pool?
Oh, man. You know what everybody's talking about, you know, the head-to-head duel of Ryan and Michael, which will obviously be fun to watch. You know, those two are the best racers in the world, and so any race they'll be in. But you know what, I'm really excited to watch my two teammates, Rebecca Soni in her breaststroke races, and also Jessica Hardy in the sprints. You know, I really enjoyed Jess. We got to be good training partners this year. So, you know, I'm looking forward to her 50 and 100 free. And then on top of that, you know, I'm super excited for Ricky Behrens to be able to get to swim the 200 free individually. So, you know, it's always fun to watch your teammates compete on the biggest stage in the world. And, you know, that's really what this is all about, is just seeing each other perform at our best when it matters most.
Absolutely. Well, Eric, you're an inspiration and a fan favorite to millions of people around the world, and I wish you the absolute best heading into London. We'll certainly be cheering for you. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
All right. Thanks for having me. It was good talking to you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our show for today. Thank you so much for joining us on Off the Wall on Swimming World Radio, and we hope you will tune in again next week.